Hello, and welcome to Medium Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is June 24th, 2004. Today's session number is ERD 2004-09. Today's speaker is Dan Erlander. The lesson for today is St. Francis of Assisi. Francis, summoned out to mission and peacemaking. Let's listen in.
This is the fourth of our classes on St. Francis of Assisi. And to those out in radio land, I'm just announcing my hello and welcome to the people in this room. Isn't that sweet? I hadn't showed this before and I couldn't find the color picture, but this is the cross that Francis knelt before when he went into the broken down church at San Damiano. And you can see that if you see it closer, you see it's a very kind Christ on the cross. And I'll just leave it out here. Or should I pass it around?
This is a
library book that was printed on the 800th anniversary of Francis. And it has pictures from the movie Brother, Sun, Sister, Moon, but then it has about 50 essays in it. So, there. I have on the board kind of a review, so where we've been so far. Francis, I'll get out of the way here. Born in 1182 in Assisi in central Italy. What we've been following is 1202, 1203, when he went off to war between the city-states and became a prisoner of war. And became very, very sick. And going home to 1203, his time of recovery, his dream of being a knight to be fulfilled then, and going off to war to fight with the armies of the Pope against the Holy Roman Empire. And on the way to that war is when he hears his first voice that calls him away from the war and home, where he is meant to be, take over his father's cloth merchant business. And then it's at the Church of San Damiano, down the hill from Assisi, that he hears the voice of Christ in this cross that was calling him with the words, "Build my church." And then taking that literally, he collects rocks to rebuild this church. And during this period, he rebuilds three broken-down churches. 1207 is when his father brings him on trial before the bishop, and this is when Francis announced his separation from his father. And then he's not really having a sense of what he will be doing, but works in leprosariums. And then it's on a mass in San Damiano that he hears the call of Matthew 10 as Jesus instructs his disciples to go out with nothing, only one cloak, no shoes, no bag, no staff, and then to go out and preach with the good news of the kingdom of God and heal the sick, cleanse the lepers. And that's when he receives the call. He's summoned out what he should be. Have you heard that before? And then then others start to follow him. Rio Torto is a beautiful wooded area where they start. The little group of what later would be called Franciscans. 1209, they go to Rome. Because in that day, because of the power of the church, you needed to have a fellowship like theirs approved by the Pope. And there he receives the approval of their order and their rule of how they will live together according to Matthew 10. And then back and the very few brothers at this time then go out town to town with their singing and preaching and joyful message and calling the people to repent. And also to live in peace with one another and forgive their enemies. Then it's also the time when Claire, who founded the parallel order to the Franciscans, escapes from her family. And then 1212 is his failed trip to Syria. He wanted to be a missionary to the Muslims, and really felt that if they only heard the gospel from him, that they would be converted. But a storm turned them around, so that failed. Then something we haven't talked about is 1213 was the first General Assembly, and this for a while was once a year, and then by the time the Brotherhood had reached thousands, it was every other year. And what this was, at St. Mary's, which was down the hill from San Damiano, which was down the hill from Assisi, which was down the hill from the Citadel, which was down the hill from the top of the mountain. It was here at St. Mary's, where in a big field, all the brothers would gather together for the annual meeting. And then it soon got to be hundreds, then more hundreds, and then thousands, and then thousands of the followers from all over. And by it wasn't long until this was spread to France, to Germany, and even to Norway, as I read in one book, the Franciscan Brotherhood. They would all come together and basically nothing organized, because you depend upon God for everything. And God came to take care of them through sympathetic town people. Who, can you imagine, they set up the little portable toilets. People set up the tables and brought the food. And this is where the brothers all came together. And then tomorrow especially, we'll talk about some very critical things that happened as we move to like 1217, 1218, 1219, and after that to the Order of Franciscans. So that will be tomorrow. But today I want to cover what I think is one of the most exciting chapters in the life of St. Francis, and that is his relationship to the Fifth Crusader War. I could just mention that at these meetings, the food came from the towns, and here they were organized into different provinces where they worked throughout the world. One of the controversies that they had is that when they went out, to be vulnerable. And what that meant is to have no piece of paper from the Pope that approved them. And Francis, being the follower of Jesus the way he was, said Jesus had no papers with him. Jesus was vulnerable, and so will we. And this meant that often they were met with suspicion, even violence, but they had to win the hearts of the people by their love, or, as Barb says, by their lamb power. What the opposite of that would be very much like, some say the reason there was so little church growth in China until after the missionaries all left, was that they were always protected by the armies of the colonial powers.
And so Francis was really doing the opposite of that. They had servant names. There was no hierarchy. I'm sure they didn't have Robert's Rules of Order either, but they were servant names like ministers and custodians and guardians. So that takes us up to this time now when Francis has gone to Syria, and that trip failed. He went to Spain to be a missionary and becomes very, very ill. And to think now from this time until his death, a progressive when you're getting more sick and more sick, is that progressive illness progressive illness of both, who knows what medical experts say, what was wrong with him, but it was everything. His body was already beginning to close down. A big part of it was malaria that he gained when he was in the cave as a POW, that the malaria kept reoccurring. But there were many other things that have been diagnosed and since then. So now it's the next vision that Francis has and dream. And that is, can land power or love power stop the Fifth Crusade? Does it sound like a big program? I had a fancier word, but that's
daunting.
What?
Daunting.
Daunting, that's exactly the word I thought of last night. Daunting program. What? You need two. Daunting program. Here is a situation that the gathering for the great battle of the Fifth Crusade was forming at the Egyptian city of Damietta. You'll have a test on that someday. Damietta. A major port city in Egypt on the eastern arm of the Nile, and probably the wealthiest city in Egypt at that time. And the battle would be between the Christian armies and the Muslim armies. A disaster of leadership change happened in 1218, and that was when Spanish Cardinal Pelagio Galvani, I'll just say Pelagio, became the commander of the Christian armies now for the battle in Egypt. And he was known as vain, stubborn, inflexible, would not listen to sound advice, and imperious. So now that's the situation now of the leadership of the Christian armies. Francis, with his dream of stopping this war, gets onto a boat that ships supplies to the armies. And there are so many people going to fight in the war that there were over 1,000 people on this ship going from Italy to Egypt, across the Mediterranean. And it was so crowded that many died on the way, and many of them on the boat were murderers and robbers that were doing this crusade to gain clemency from their crimes. So that's the situation on the boat. So they went in and joined 100,000 Christian soldiers. And by Christian soldiers, I mean here the armies of the papacy. And their goal now was to defeat the Muslims here, with the ultimate goal of reconquering the Holy Land in Jerusalem for the Christians. When Francis got there, he was aghast because there had been a battle, and he was surrounded not only by all of these soldiers, but rotting corpses, tropical diseases, lack of food and water, and the Saracens is the name of the army of the Muslims. The Saracens, they had defeated the Christians, and they were in high morale. And now Pelagia, the new commander, is going to lead the Christian troops against the heavily fortified city of Damietta. Now, Pelagia, this is some of his qualifications. He had no strategic organization. He had no really good plan. Then stubbornly rejected all the offers that the Muslim brought for a truce. And so the Crusaders made their first attack against the walls of the city, and one-fifth of the army immediately perished in this failed attempt. And the survivors, many, many of them, crowded onto supply ships going back to Europe. They'd had enough of this kind of war. The morale was low, and the leaders of the Christian armies had this dream that if you're all fighting for Jesus Christ, you're going to get along. The common people were culturally different than the nobility and the knights, and so they started not killing, but fighting and arguing and jealousy between the different groups, class hatred, you would call it. Now, the Muslim commander was one who believed, why didn't I write his name down? Do you want to sing a song?
Just say, oh, what's his name?
Oh, what's his name? Here we go. It's a sultan. It's Sultan al-Kamil. Sultan al-Kamil. Because he'll be a very, very important figure now, and also a hero.
Will that be in the quiz?
No. I would never give a quiz. I would flunk. Sultan al-Kamil, the Muslim commander, and he desires not to go to this war, the next battle. He is one who basically hates war. I mean, he is just the great example of the just war theory, that war is only the last resort. He knows the power of the Christian armies, so he says it's time for us to negotiate for a peace, to offer, in order that there be unnecessary bloodshed. So here's what the peace offer is now to the Christians, who more and more troops now are coming and gathering. One was the offer that the relics of the true cross would be returned to the Christians. Now, that doesn't sound like much to us, but to them, this was so much of the crusade. Then the kingdom of Jerusalem would be given to the Christians. Leaders give reasons for going to war. I don't know if you've watched the news for the last year. Reasons for going to war, and this was the major reason for this strike, was to regain Jerusalem as a Christian city. and he offered it to them as part of this truce, only not including the roads between Jerusalem and Egypt. And then on top of that, offered a 30-year truce. And the only thing the Christians would have to do is leave Egypt, let Egypt alone. And it's all they wanted when they first started giving the arguments for this war. And Pelagius just simply says no, against his advisors, and also with the idea that, my goodness, if we keep on fighting, we'll even get more concessions. Now, Francis, into this situation, goes into the Christian camp. And he would be well known, because by this time he's known all over Italy, as a preacher and as a peacemaker and as a joyful monk with a winning and winsome personality and a great preacher and a lover of humanity, comes in preaching and then throws himself into nursing the sick and the wounded soldiers. He has a sense of how things are going, and he favors the truce because he warns that the Christian army is going to be defeated. Today we would call this meddling in politics. Now, then something terrible happened. The Saracens, the Muslims, sent spies into the Christian camp. These spies would be, they would swim through the waters because this encampment now is right on the Nile. These would be the early Navy SEALs, very special trained forces. But the Christians catch them. And then the Christians, this is what they do to them before they send them back. They cut off their noses, their lips, their ears, and for each one they thought, they gouge out one eye. And then send them back. And Francis is just totally revolted over this. So the revenge then is that the Muslims send a swift troop into the Christian camp. And I haven't figured this out, but evidently there were families with the Christian encampment. Would have been almost like a city. And they sneak in and take women and children. And before they run away, they impale them. Is that what we mean by? They impale them on swords and spikes and then rush back. And you see what's happening here? Does it remind you of anything? Now Francis is just shocked by this act and by this revenge. And again announces that the siege of the walls will fail. And he by this time is joined by other Franciscan brothers who join him in the preaching. And just imagine this, what we're talking about is anti-war preaching going on right in the encampment of Christian soldiers. Francis is, I gotta back up just once, before they do this, Francis has to make a decision. Is he going to be this outspoken about the war? And this shows Francis, just wasn't the hero type every minute, like the saint with no problems whatsoever. And he says, if I do this preaching against this war, they're going to call me a fool. And his brothers who are there laugh, and they just gather around him and say, Francis, how many times have you been called a fool? And then he realizes probably several thousand times. So he begins the proclamation. Now, and then following and with the proclamation now, he and the other brothers fan out to one to John, who is the papal advisor, to Pelagio, the commander, to the garrison leaders, setting up meetings with each of the garrison leaders, and also they speak to many of the troops. And they win the agreement of almost everyone that this war will be a disaster. And so all they really basically win the whole army. But then they go to Pelagio, the commander, and he says, absolutely not. We are going to this war, even if all the arguments are against it. He will not listen to the arguments. And so then the next step is the Muslims offer a vast sum of money on top of all the other things they agreed to, of giving Jerusalem to the Christians, giving the true pieces of the Holy Cross to the Christians. And now he absolutely refused. So he leads the attack. And the Christian armies are drawn in. They do not understand the rising and the falling and the personality of the Nile River. And soon they are stuck in a place surrounded, and they have no water to drink, and they get more and more thirsty. And so then in that desperate situation, then the Muslim armies attack them, and 6,000 are killed and in retreat. And now they have lost, the Christians have lost the first skirmish. And then Al-Kamil, then after this, even offers all of the previous terms for peace, and includes the promise to restore all the broken walls of the city of Jerusalem and to release all of the Christian hostages, and then to send 20 Muslim noblemen as hostages to stay in Italy until the walls are restored and the promises are kept. And Pelagia says, absolutely not. So Francis now is very, very angry. And he decides the only way to stop the bloodshed that is soon to come is to go to Al-Kamil himself. And has this idea that today we would call this ideal rather naive, but it is how fervently Francis believed in the power of the gospel. That if I go to Al-Kamil, and it's just the two of us, and by the way, they're the same age, Francis and Al-Kamil, go with to him, and I will preach the gospel to him, and he will become a Christian, and then he will declare that all the troops and all the Muslims will become Christians, and then there will be no reason for the war. Does this sound naive to you? But his idea too is that, as always, you never convert other people only by talking, but by examples of love, of peacemaking, of listening, of respecting, by example. So he takes Illuminato, one of the brothers who speaks a little Arabic, as his translator, and then several other of the Franciscans. And then he goes into the area of the Muslim armies. And this is very strange to them. So basically let them pass through, really for two reasons. The way they're dressed, they look like Sufis. Some of you read about them, the Muslim mystics. And they also think that maybe they are Christian negotiators, you know, they're maybe coming back with a word about the truce. So they let them go, and so Francis Illuminato and the others. Now this I forgot is how many others, but I know it's Elise Francis and Illuminato. They go right up to the tent of the Sultan. And here they meet the Sultan for the first time. And this is what we know now about the Sultan. And by the way, all of this that I'm saying today was very carefully recorded very, very early. So this, and then there have been other stories that have grown out of it, which I'll include one or two, but I'll tell you. The Sultan is a dedicated and a very pious Muslim. As I mentioned, he hates war, and he sees war as a last resort. And also, he is a great military strategist, but he's more interested in his five times a day prayer time than he is in military strategy. So Francis now comes before a devout and a pacific man who is also a believer in the one God. And then Francis begins his sermon. And basically what Francis does is to give a little lesson in Bible history to the Sultan, and also invites him to faith in Jesus Christ. Now this was critical, because I think it might maybe still be true in the Muslim world that preaching to Muslims and trying to convert them is punishable by death. Weren't there the young women that were in Afghanistan that were arrested for? They weren't killed, but it was a very dangerous.
Yeah, they were accused of proselytizing.
Yeah, accused of proselytizing. So, and at that time it was beheading. So, I mean, the natural thing now would be, well, there it is. Francis is to be beheaded. And then he pleaded for peace between the armies in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. The counselors to the Sultan then just went up to advise the Sultan that we will behead Francis right now. And but the Sultan, remember all the way back to the king of the party, the personality of Francis, the winsome personality, the Sultan likes him. He likes him, and he's deeply impressed by his commitment to his faith, and even more deeply impressed with his contempt for the luxuries of the world. So he's alone now with Francis, and he says, I will not behead you. I admire that you have risked your life to save me before the God in whom you believe. And now this is what I am going to do to you. I want to invite you to be my special guest for a week. And do they have fun together? Because they both love to speak and talk theology. And so they get into this mutual conversation about Islam and Christianity and the teachings of Islam and the teaching of Christianity. They compare the New Testament with the Quran. And then they find places where there's agreement and disagreement. And these two same age young men are having fun. Now Francis will not be a martyr, and Sultan is so impressed with him that he says to him, this is what I want to do for you. What is something you would really like? And Francis said, I would love to see the holy sites. And the Muslims controlled the holy site. So the Sultan arranged guards and others to take Francis to Jerusalem. And then also to take with him, he brought all kinds of provisions and money for the trip. And Francis very graciously refused everything. Remember what I told you, that the greatest fear that Francis has that he might get something? So graciously he refuses. And now this might be a later addition, but it was that the Sultan just said, "My goodness, the first Christian I've ever known of that didn't want gold." So then the siege begins of the Christian armies, and Damietta is taken. And Damietta, a city of 80,000 inhabitants, only 3,000 are left when the walls are breached. The city is filled with corpses. The first reports were of children still alive, climbing on their dead parents. I mean, all the worst atrocities of war. And then many, many of the Christian troops then went home, but the other troops now are going to march on to Cairo, because this is just the city to pass on the way to Cairo. And here Al-Kamil surrounds the remaining Christian troops, and they have now no alternative but to accept a truce. So in 1221, an armistice is signed. The Christians agree to leave Egypt. The Fifth Crusade is ended, and never again is there a papal crusade to regain the Holy Land. So on February 1220, Francis returns now, and he returns to Italy after his trip to the holy sites, to Bethlehem and Jerusalem. And he comes back to find out that the first martyrdom of Franciscans has happened in Spain. And on inspecting what happened is that now that he has been sensitized and Muslim people have become human to him, and he has become endeared to Muslim people, he finds out that they went up there to Spain, or over to Spain, to try to be martyrs. With no sensitivity whatsoever, to just yell at the, in sermons, yelling at the Muslims, so they were quickly killed. And then in 1219, I have my dates mixed up. The 1221 would have been after Francis is back to Italy. And he returned for the Pentecost chapter, and this was a big meeting in the field. The big meeting in the field for the every other year. And they called it the Pentecost chapter. And there, now he comes back to what will be our subject for tomorrow. The Franciscan order there now, with the thousands of brothers gathered, is in disarray. And the disarray is over the argument, shall we still keep Matthew 10 and the simple rule of St. Francis, or shall we become more comfortable and more realistic? So I will stop there and just invite your responses to one of the greatest and the most courageous nonviolent peacemaking endeavors that ever happened in history.
in the midst of this fighting, do we know what Francis and his Franciscan brothers were up to?
Yeah, during
were they huddled together for fear of the fighting outside? What were they doing?
Yeah, that I don't know. And that's something I'd like to find more. This is a confession, I guess, in a way. I've basically read the biographies, which cover so much material that this war in this part can only have several pages. So I'd really be interested in that. So Michael, that's your assignment. or I'll look for it too. So, what were they doing during the fighting? Could I guess? They were ministering to the wounded and the sick and the dying. That would be my guess.
Do you have any reason to believe that the Christians were disturbed by their presence among the Muslims and their return or during the war?
Were they disturbed by the war?
Been disturbed by the fact that they had gone over to the Muslim side.
Oh, that the Francis and, well, they were, yeah, the only thing I know is that they were considered fools, because it was basically when the leader gave them permission to go, he told them it's a suicide mission, that I'm not going to stop you. So that would have been probably the general, that Francis has really gone off of his rocker, as we used to say in grade school. Gone off, just... this was a suicide mission.
Yeah. Dan, there is a word attributed to Francis, supposedly. You kind of alluded to it earlier, that the call to the Christian is to preach the gospel and, if necessary, even use words.
Yeah.
Do you, from your research, conclude that that's an authentic word from Francis, or is it simply an expression of his way, his style of preaching the gospel?
Yeah.
Did he say that?
Yeah, and that I haven't seen that in the biographies I've read. I would guess it's later, but it certainly says what his life was.
Mm-hmm.
And it also...
acted out, you have to then add words.
Yeah, and it doesn't quite fit, because Francis basically did both at the same time. He was always preaching, but always serving.
With words.
Both words.
Dan, you mentioned you had a couple of stories which may have been apocryphal or perhaps not, and you would tell us that you're now telling those stories. Do you want to tell us those couple of stories?
Oh, yeah, there's one story about when they were going through the Muslim armies. The other one was... the other one was, and I think it could be quite accurate, because there's real kind of surprise humor in this, that Francis's first words to the Sultan was, I have a way to stop this war and stop the fighting, which the Sultan would have been very interested in, because that was his desire. And so he asked him, what is it? And Francis says, it's just very simple. If you would convert to faith in Jesus Christ, and then all of your followers would convert, then the war would be over. And the early stories was that he just fell off of his chair laughing. I mean, he didn't get angry. I mean, this was so bizarre. He just fell over just rollicking, laughing. And then the other story is the one I did tell about, which probably was a later edition too, about what the first Christian I've ever met or heard of didn't want gold. Which was quite indicting, isn't it? So, and very, very touched, you know, by Francis' simplicity and desire for nothing for himself. And also what touched both of them about each other was their deep faith in God. And also Francis was very, very touched by the five times of prayer and the call to prayer and to see all of the Muslims praying. And he dreamed of taking that back to Europe. He dreamed and he preached when he got back. And being realistic this time, he thought it could, if it were only one time a day, when the bells of the church would ring and every Christian, wherever you are, kneel down in prayer. Which is one way of saying that some said that he went there to convert and he came back converted to seeing Muslims as human beings, and especially with the Sultan, which intellectually and spiritually they just became one. It's one of the, for me, it's a real goosebump story. It gives me. And the reversal of a good fighting army must in some way stereotype and hate in some way the other people. And for Francis, that ended any idea that left of that. And so,
this is such a great example of when Barb might be in cahoots. her call for another narrative in the face of dispensationalist propaganda. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And here's another narrative of women's power. So it's a beautiful intersection.
How could we, like the story I've just told you, how did these stories catch on?
Well, I was just thinking of a bumper sticker with a little picture of the Sultan, and Francis just says, if you all can convert. And I could see your drawing. He's falling off a stool laughing, just saying, you've got to be kidding. Sultan al Khalid.
And at the bottom, it could be the yougottabekidding.com.
Is there any record of their discussion, of their comparison of the Gospels and the Quran?
Well, any record of exactly how they compared?
Uh-huh.
I'd be very interested in that, because the one thing I've read is that this was written down immediately after this whole incident, and wouldn't it be fun to see exactly what they talked about and how they compared and what they learned from each other. But not that I know of, but which brings up the topic. I mean, there is not as much, but there is almost as much research done on the historical Francis's, on the historical Jesus. You know, scholars, his whole lifetime.
Dan, do you know if there's evidence?
I hear a voice, but
do you know if there's evidence that Francis also had that kind of entree with Pelagia? And it sounds like that's the person he should have been talking to.
Yeah. What I do know is that he really tried. And what you read about this man is one of the most. He was a man who had his mind all made up and was dedicated to listening to no evidence to the contrary, which militarily is a disaster. But he was impenetrable. You know, every report we have that he would not listen, and even. And see, John, the representative from the papacy, when Pelagia was appointed general, after John, and I don't know the reasons why the change, but then the Pope appointed John, the former commander who was a listener, he appointed him to be the papal legate, is that what the word, the papal legate to the armies and to the commander, with the assumption that he would listen to him. And he was, John was part of those who pleaded with the general collegio to accept the offer. It's everything they wanted at the beginning, but then he was obsessed with war.
Staying the course. But staying the course.
Yeah, you could, staying the course is what you, if anybody wants to have any parallels to anything in our sure, welcome.
I would take this question. Who is the St. Francis today?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anybody want to try to...
Where's the St. Francis today?
I, you know, there are ones that are trying to speak to power, but it's difficult. Does anybody have an answer to that?
Mennonites or Quakers?
I think the Quaker Church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, one, maybe someone can correct me on this if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that the Bush administration has not met with mainline Christian leaders. And
Bush himself has not.
But
Bush himself has
himself,
not.
Others, yeah. Others.
Some of his.
I know our bishop of the ELC has tried.
They met. Some of them met recently with Colin Powell, and they've met with Condoleezza Rice.
Yeah. So the access to power is very, very difficult.
Dan, do you wonder if some of the, as you described Francis and some of the things I've read about him before, part of the reason I like him is he actually was, when he was younger, he was funny, he was engaging and all those things. Do you wonder if some of it was, some of this, his approach to the Sultan was ironic? I mean, if the first thing out of his mouth is trying to just convert him, surely he knew that in one sentence he would convert him, and that part of his appeal, even with him, was that irony or sense of great sense of humor he must have had in order to just entertain people.
And how much
of it was naivety, and how much of it was just plain humor and self-effacement?
Mm-hmm. That's fun to guess about, because I think Francis had learned from his. He was a trained comedian.
Yeah.
This is what he learned when he was a youth. And part of that is to get around the fences with types of absurdity.
Yeah.
The other possibility was he just guileless.
Yeah.
You know, guileless in a way that actually became endearing to the Sultan.
I was wondering about the commander. He said he was from Spain, right? Or the
He was from Spain, but his name sounds Italian.
Yeah.
So
I was just wondering. I think at the time, the Muslim world had made quite a huge inroad into Spain, and I was just wondering if there's anything that you've read that would suggest that maybe one of the reasons how he was so close-minded had to do with what he perceived had happened to his home country, Spain, relative to the Muslim intrusions.
Yeah, that's very possible, because to see this in context, you know, because it was the fear that the Muslims would take over all of Europe. So sometimes, you know, that can change a person or the whole staying portion of it. If we lose here, then we'll. And also, but at the same time, one of the reasons that the Sultan was making generous offers is the Muslim world was being threatened from the east at this time. So this is all the kind of, say, geopolitical things that are going on at this time.
I just comment also on a question earlier about the comparison between the Quran and Christianity. And
the what?
Between comparison between Christianity and the Muslim beliefs in terms of where what they believe, where the commonality was. We attended a 5-week course where the purpose of that was to try and take a look at Islam as a faith and see where we were common rather than what was keeping us apart. And the conclusion of it was that there was a whole lot more commonality than what people really want to believe. Mm-hmm. That fundamentally, in terms of many of the lifestyles that are professed, they're very, very similar. Mm-hmm. And really, the fundamental departure point is they clearly believe that there is one God. And as soon as you get to the point of saying in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, i.e. the triune God, that's when you begin to have your fundamental differences.
It's one of the blessings, you know, the strange blessings that came after 9/11, that Christian churches all over the United States were studying Islam. And I know in our church we found the three Arab Muslims on the island. I don't know how many times we had them over. And I think Francis found some of that commonality. But I mean, I don't think he became a what is the word used? A religious universalist anything at that time. Well, six. I wanted to close with this. Where we moved so far, Francis either has failed or is failing on every dream that he has had. You know, one of his great dreams was to be a martyr. You know, my goodness, he's tried. So he goes away from Egypt. He's failed at being a martyr. And now he's just failed to stop the war, which the pain from this war was excruciating. So he's failed at that. And now our next lesson beginning tomorrow, his dream with the order will fail. And that's why the last session we will call Francis' pathway to the cross. That's where I think we'll move most deeply into the spiritual life of Francis, that in his life he parallels the failure of Jesus Christ as Jesus was crucified. So that will be tomorrow. So I love this, so thank you.